good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player, which is available on our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you'd like to connect with us, please post a question on our wall on Facebook or send me a tweet at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is sponsored by RamVPN.com, the leading provider of next-generation online anonymity and VPN security solutions. Their architecture is unique, tamper-safe, and 100% guaranteed. They even accept Bitcoin. Listeners of the Organic View Radio Show can receive a 15% discount in 3-month and 6-month personal plans by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW. For more promotional offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. Are USDA scientists under attack for doing their job? What exactly is the USDA scientific integrity policy? As we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my special guest co-host, Colorado beekeeper Tom Theobald, and I are going to talk to Mr. Jeff Rook, the executive director of the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. So first, I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Mr. Theobald.
Good afternoon, June.
No weather report this week?
Well, I was wondering whether I should. It's overcast. It's one of those days where you want to settle in by the wood stove with a nice book. Nice day. Quiet.
Thank you, Tom.
For the program.
I think that's becoming my favorite part of the show. Just kidding.
Uh-huh.
And next, I would like to welcome Mr. Jeff Rook. Good afternoon, Jeff, and thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Jeff, could you share with our listeners what you do at PEER and exactly how you got involved with them?
Well, PEER is a service organization for people who work in agencies like the EPA, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we sort of function as a shelter for battered staff. Employees who cross political lines, get in trouble for being institutionally inconvenient, whistleblowers, come to us for assistance. And we provide free legal assistance. We help them get issues raised in the public domain. We do an awful lot of Freedom of Information Act, both requests and litigation. In essence, we are the answer to the question of how can we help you? And so we find rangers, even agency attorneys, as well as scientists in various levels of career distress, often at a crossroads between their careers and their conscience, and we try and provide them assistance. In the case of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, their Agriculture Research Service, their science arm, there's been a lot of cutting-edge work on topics like neonic pesticides, genetically modified crops, and the like, but those research topics tend to draw a lot of scrutiny from agency upper management, which in turn is under pressure from agribusiness. And so we are finding scientists who are suffering negative personal career consequences of various kinds, everything from being denied the ability to make presentations or publish, all the way to disciplinary actions and threats of termination because of the content of their work.
Jeff, could you take a moment and share with the listeners exactly what the USDA scientific integrity policy entails?
Sure. In reaction to the excesses of the Bush administration, President Obama, very early in his term, declared that we weren't going to allow the political manipulation of science or the reprisal against scientists. So he directed each agency to come up with their own scientific integrity policy. And it took USDA quite a while, and in 2013 they came up with a policy that is very weak and in some cases contradictory, and in other cases even the cause of a problem. So, for example, the USDA policy forbids scientists from, discussing their research, from making any direct or indirect comment on the implications of any federal policy of any agency. Well, that's a gag order that is so broad that it basically could be used to prevent scientists from saying anything that's interesting. And we've experienced scientists who've been told to take their name off papers because it reflects badly on current agricultural practices that are supported by USDA.
Throughout the last couple of years, Tom and I have witnessed some of situations, rather, where we've seen what can happen with some of the scientists without getting into specific details. And it's getting to the point where if you work as a scientist, you almost have to walk on eggshells, because if you talk about research that might jeopardize a particular industry, the grant money might be pulled or your position might be shuffled where you're sent off to another college with another position, or you might even be demoted, as was the case with one particular situation, which, once again, I'm not going to go into details during this interview, but for the folks that have been listening over the past couple of years and have been following everything that's been going on with American scientists, they understand exactly what I'm referring to. So in regards to USDA and the scientists that they employ, do you find that young scientists that are taking positions are often opting to go with private industry instead of working for the government? I mean, is it getting to the point where it's that critical?
Well, it's where we're seeing the rubber meet the road is not on the young incoming scientists. It's the lab directors and supervisors. That's where the rubber's meeting the road, and it's actually that middle management is where the focus of pressure is, and that in turn is discouraging young people from staying because they can see where this is going to lead. One point I wanted to make was just how delicate scientific careers are even in government. So, for example, you need official permission to submit your research for publication in a peer-reviewed journal. If you don't get that permission, outside of the scientific integrity policy, assuming that it works, you have no options. The civil service system doesn't even consider that a personnel action. But as a practical matter, if you're a scientist that in these positions that goes 2 and 3 years without having any publications, professionally speaking, you might as well have been in a coma.
Wow.
So the scientific career path is very delicate, and there are lots of ways that can mess with you by preventing you from making poster presentations at conferences, and the like, that for the most part has been their sole prerogative, and that's why these scientific integrity policies are potentially so significant. The other aspect of this is that there's a saying that everyone's entitled to their own opinion but not their own set of facts. In government, that's not true. For the most part, absent these kind of protections, managers can order studies rewritten, critical findings removed, so that the facts support the pre-decided agenda. And that's why we think, among other reasons, we think these policies are so important, because if for the first time these scientific and technical publications and findings have some sort of legal status and can't be removed at the whim of management, that changes the whole balance of power within the agency and changes how decisions are made. It makes it harder for political appointees to ignore inconvenient facts.
So if someone experiences pressure, retaliation, what have you, and without officially being blackballed, they are, how do they recover from that? That's got to be horrific, especially after so many years of schooling, the money, just everything, the dedication, and then to go through something like that. I just can't imagine.
In most cases, they leave. Part of the reason we're so concerned about a viable scientific integrity policy is that scientists in these agencies have very few legal rights. So thanks to the Roberts Supreme Court, they decided in Samuel Alito's first swing decision that government employees at all levels have no, as in zero, First Amendment protection on the job. So if they're acting as government employees, they have no free speech rights. And the court reasoned that's because the government owns their speech. It's almost like a form of indentured. It's almost like you're in prison. And the only way a government employee regains First Amendment protections is by stepping outside their role as a civil servant and, say, writing a letter to the editor or standing on a soapbox in the middle of the park. For the most part, government scientists aren't doing that. Everything they're doing is a matter of their role as a government employee. Further, scientists rarely find themselves within the protections of whistleblower protection law. So in order to be a whistleblower, you have to disclose a violation of law, rule, or regulation, gross waste and mismanagement, or danger to public health and safety. Well, they're not talking about that. They're talking about soil conditions. They're talking about population distribution. They're talking about rates of reproduction. Those things aren't violations of law. That's not gross waste and mismanagement. And so when that work is altered, they're outside of the coverage of the statutory protections. And so that's why we're turning to these scientific integrity rules, which for the first time create rules that supposedly say technical papers won't be changed for non-technical reasons, and you won't be retaliated against due to the content of your research.
Jeff, how do you go up against such a big monster, if you will, like USDA? It's so intimidating.
Our approach is incremental. Things change over time, but you have to go back to them again and again like water on a rock. So you're talking not only about legal changes, but you're also talking about cultural changes as to, in terms of what's accepted and what's tolerated. So, for example, if a senior manager is finally disciplined in a public way for retaliating against a scientist, that's a major step toward changing the culture of an agency. That kind of thing becomes almost legend. And so that's why we're trying to enforce these policies. In some cases, even when there's not formal action taken, there's what we call the Google legacy of their actions, the proof of their actions follows them around for the rest of their life. So it takes a long time, but we think it's worth it. And in the years that we've been doing this, in terms of the public reaction as well as the institutional reaction to whistleblowers, when you think about it, we've come a long way in the last, say, 20 years. It used to be that whistleblowers were always thought of as traitors and malcontents, and now whenever there's a scandal, one of the first questions people ask is, why weren't there whistleblowers? There's sort of now a public expectation there should be whistleblowers, and that wasn't the case years ago. Similarly, on this issue, up until the kind of the excesses of the Bush administration, I don't think people thought about scientific integrity as an issue within government. These kind of changes went on for years and years in prior administrations, Democrat and Republican, but under Bush it was so widespread and open on topics like climate change, of having coal company executives come in to positions inside the White House and rewrite things. It was just so outrageous that it framed the issue that was begging to be framed. And now that it's been framed and sort of codified into official policy, it's a matter of filling it in. I liken it to a new body of law rising like a volcanic island from the seabed. It's uneven. It's steaming. There's still holes in it. It's young. But if you can fill this in and it becomes a decent-sized island, it is a change in the landscape.
Have any senior managers been sanctioned for violating the rights of the scientists?
We can't point to one. So we work in a lot of federal agencies. One work area we work in is the Department of Interior, and there we worked in two cases where review panels found managers guilty of different things. In one case, changing a model; in another case, falsifying a research paper. They were supposed to have been punished. The review panel recommended they be punished, but they weren't. One immediately went to work for the oil industry, and the other transferred to a high-level position in another agency. In the meantime, the three scientists that were involved in those two complaints together suffered a total of, I think it was 10 suspensions without pay, and we worked to get those reversed. But it's not clear what the legacy is. But the difference is the fact that 10 years ago, they wouldn't have been able to bring this complaint at all, let alone get an official finding that their management was guilty. The system didn't work completely, but it's beginning to be a system.
Mm-hmm. So the people that were responsible, or the person, I don't know how many people were involved, but the supervisor, what have you, is there any way to create some sort of policy where if someone is brought up on disciplinary charges as far as being a supervisor and falsifying records, documentation, what have you, is there any way from prohibiting them from just leaving altogether and then getting a big fat job in private industry? I mean, it almost seems like it's a reward.
Well, there's no way to prevent somebody from quitting.
No. But, I mean, it just seems as though...
And that's, in fact, what they did. And these policies say that the managers are supposed to... that those responsible are supposed to be held to account. So the fact that that's on paper is a big development. It's a matter of filling that in and making sure that it actually comes to pass.
Well, it's just in the private sector, if you do something that's unethical, that tends to haunt you, especially if you're a supervisor. And it's just interesting that if someone who's working for the government does something that's unethical, then they can just leave scot-free, no punishment, no nothing. And
well, there's some haunting. So we've displayed all the documents on these cases on our website, including the findings of the panels that name these managers. And so when you Google their names, this is the first thing that comes up. And so it's an indelible stain that will follow them until they do something else noteworthy, which is now doubtful. And so while that sort of informal retribution is not what's envisioned by the policy, it's better than what happened before. So the fact that these reviews produce documents that we can obtain, though in this case we had to threaten a lawsuit to obtain them, once they're out there forever.
Mm. Jeff, could you take a moment and share some of the successes that PURE has had?
Well, one of the recent successes was we've just capped off a legal campaign that forced the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to kick genetically modified crops and neonic pesticides off of all the national wildlife refuges in the country. And that was sort of a long time in coming. Most recently, I think we forced the EPA and the Consumer Product Safety Commission to back off their public assurances that artificial turf made from shredded tires is safe to play on. We won some of the biggest whistleblower cases in federal government history, and we've also won a fair number of lawsuits that have come out of either those whistleblower cases or from people who decided to use our services rather than become whistleblowers. So we're kind of an active group. We file a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit about once every 3 weeks because we find that the work under FOIA often is a safe alternative for people blowing the whistle. So people come to us and say, here are the documents, here's what they say, or in some cases they leak us the documents and ask us to go get them officially out the front door, and so that the agency, in essence, has to admit that this dirty laundry is theirs.
Jeff, what is the process for a scientist to communicate with you? Can they just email you, call you?
Sure. Our website is peer.org.
Oh, okay. And
there's a blow-the-whistle portion on it, and all communications with us is confidential. Symbolic of the way we work, I'm going to pitch my underwear now. The only product we sell on our website is underwear, boxer shorts, that say undercover activists in the butt and our logo on the leg so you can safely wear them to work. So while we protect whistleblowers, I think the best thing that we do is we help employees avoid having to be in the position of being a whistleblower. So the idea of a lone individual, even with assistance, fighting a large agency is usually an unfair fight. And these whistleblower cases turn on some personnel action. Were you wrongly fired or transferred or had your duties taken away? It's a battle that is waged entirely within your personnel jacket, and that's the least strategic terrain on which to fight. Instead, if you can bring the fight to the agency and force the agency to deal with the message and not the messenger. That's generally produces the best results with the least amount of collateral damage.
Jeff, without getting into specifics, could you share with the listeners who may not quite comprehend the depth of how, may not comprehend how, sensitive reporting this information is, what some of the ramifications could be if someone were to report something that is unethical or illegal for that matter?
Huh. Well, there are sort of two things. One is a lot of these scientists are in trouble not for reporting anything wrong. They're reporting, as you were saying, for doing their job. They're in trouble because they're publishing results showing that certain of these insecticides are killing non-target, very beneficial pollinators. That sort of research, without reporting any kind of wrongdoing, just that research, in some instances, will do things like trigger an internal investigation where they go through all of your financial records in order to prove you're misappropriating paperclips or that there's a discrepancy in your travel reimbursement in order to take disciplinary action against you. And those kind of things, depending upon how inconvenient they think you are, begin to mount up. And so in some instances, you end up with 2-3 disciplinary actions leading to termination over something that is technically not related to the content of your work, but is absolutely related to the content of your work. So those that report violations usually are already in that cycle because they're in a fight with management, and they're usually reporting reprisal as well as the violation. And so, as I was talking about earlier, the delicate nature of scientific work, there's ways you can be isolated that effectively are professional death that, from the civil service point of view, don't even look like official personnel actions.
My experience has been fairly limited, and mostly with the EPA and the pesticide issue, but it seems to me from the outside that in the past 5 years, it's become much more constraining. And am I seeing it correctly?
It depends upon the issue. So on this issue, ironically enough, the White House announcing that they're going to have a pollinator strategy has meant that everything that is in the flight path of this issue now gets vetted by the White House. And so you can imagine it's sort of like you put the ordinary, already intense politics on steroids.
I've been watching this proclamation, though, and my impression is that it's just a higher order of posturing, and it isn't going to accomplish much of anything.
It will run out the clock. It will run out of the clock of this administration.
Uh-huh.
And this extra layer of vetting also delays publication of further findings, and so it's... And for the most part, this is filters all the way down to the field level in terms of the kind of the level of anxiety and fear of doing something that might be considered controversial.
And yet, the EPA has just approved the application of imidacloprid on tidelands in Washington. They were forced to back off from that, but.
Right. And the head of the EPA pesticide programs, when asked about neonics, said he thought it was premature to even consider a ban, and that we should rather approach it on a holistic basis and look at pollinator habitat. And it's an astounding statement for somebody who's the head of this program to make before anywhere close to half the evidence is even in. But it suggests that they're not going to do anything. And if they're not going to do anything, then the last thing you want are these pesky scientists producing papers that make them look foolish for not doing anything. And that's exactly what's going on.
Uh-huh.
Jeff, could you also talk about some of the other campaigns that you have going on?
Boy, we have an awful lot of public lands-related campaigns as well as public health campaigns. One of the most intense cases we're involved in right now is a horribly contaminated complex of public schools in Malibu, where we're suing the school district to try and force a cleanup after almost 30 teachers have come forward with health problems. And our frustration is And one of the parents was Cindy Crawford, who took this to the Today Show. One of our frustrations is if the wealthy, well-connected parents of Malibu can't force a cleanup, what chance do people in El Monte, Newark, and poorer communities have to clean up? It's sort of baffling to us, but that's a major investment of our time right now. We're also about to unveil a right to know website for workers that displays all of the chemical exposure data from the history of OSHA back in 1984 to present, every air reading they've ever taken in a workplace, either OSHA or one of the state OSHAs, as well as the chemical content and the significance of those chemicals, so that a worker can tell if he's in a facility that was inspected by OSHA what he or she had been exposed to. So our website, which is peer.org, has a breakdown of activities by campaigns, by agency, and a separate breakdown by states. So one of the centers we have is this whole legal help center for scientists, both university as well as those in public agencies. Information about what happens when at a university you're targeted by what we call a vacuum cleaner document request. A lot of times we're helping university professors who are come under the scrutiny of usually a coal company. They're the most rapacious. Is they try and do such voluminous document requests to disrupt research and also attempt to find little snippets that can be used to embarrass the researcher. And so helping them fight back in those kind of situations where technically the university general counsel doesn't represent them. Nobody represents the individual professor. But at the same time, we don't want to alienate the university and help the university look at tools it can use to deflect these requests.
Jeff, do you ever work with any civilians or any NGOs? Are you open to working with any other groups?
Yeah, I mean, actually, NGOs are the ones who bring us a lot of our cases.
Ah.
So if you're an environmental group, a Sierra Club, environmental defense, you have your own insider sources in these agencies. But there often comes a time in that relationship where there's the smoking gun document, and the insider says, if I give this to you, what happens to me? Well, it's beyond the mission of any other organization we know to defend that person and represent them. That is our mission. And so they bring them to us. Some of these USDA scientists were brought to us by some of the groups you know are very active on these issues because they realize that they're suffering greatly on the inside and need help, and they can't provide the help. We can.
Jeff, it has been fabulous having you on the show today. If you wouldn't mind, could you just give our listeners your website one more time?
It's PEER, P-E-E-R, our name, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, produces a mercifully pronounceable acronym of PEER, peer.org.
And folks, if you would also like to support PEER, you can make a donation by clicking a link up at the top that says Give. And please,
and you can also buy underwear there.
And you can
there are
also
ways to give.
You can also buy underwear
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I want a set of that underwear.
But by all
and
means,
all shades of white.
Please do support their amazing work. And Jeff, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
It is so nice to know about the things that you're doing and that you are really doing everything possible to protect these people.
Yes, it's encouraging. I compliment you on your efforts.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Tom, always a pleasure.
Thank you, June. And Jeff, it was nice talking.
Nice talking to you.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. Please check out the companion article, which will accompany this interview at theorganicview.com. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.